welcome to Talk Is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll. And let's start with a little holiday rock and roll today. It's my first ever Christmas song, Chris Jericho and the Christmas Helves. All the proceeds from this tune, Father Christmas, benefit the Juvenile Diabetes Research Fund. You can get it wherever you buy, download, and stream music, iTunes, Amazon, Spotify. Check it out and give a little bit back. Go check it out right now. Father Christmas, Chris Jericho and the Christmas Helves. Let's hear it now. Cover of the Kinks' Father Christmas. You can get it wherever you buy and stream music, iTunes, Amazon, Spotify. Available everywhere. And remember, all proceeds go to a great cause, the JDRF Juvenile Diabetes Research Funding. So thank you for listening. And thank you for listening to the show today. I got the highwayman, Cowboy James Storm. He spent almost 20 years at TNA. And he's going to tell us why he said no to both WWE and Impact a couple years ago and decided to do his own thing on the indie scene. He's actually wrestling in the NWA Into the Fire, the pay-per-view this Saturday. He's challenging for the NWA Heavyweight Championship versus Nick Aldis, December 14th in Atlanta, Georgia. The live event is sold out, so you'll have to catch it on Fight TV. Go check that out now. But on top of that, James is also talking about his Django Django videos, his character that he plays on Instagram, where he got that idea from, what it was like tagging with the late, great Dusty Rhodes when Dusty was in TNA, what inspired the America's Most Wanted tag team with Chris Harris, how he and Bobby Roode became the very successful Beer Money, whether there'll ever be a reunion of that. I know Bobby Roode has mentioned it before. All the great stuff he learned from Ric Flair, which is actually how James and I finally met at Ric's 70th birthday party. So let's shit it and get it, boys. With James Storm right here, the Highwayman is here on Talk is Jericho. So it's interesting, after being in this business for almost 30 years now, I've pretty much met everybody, but I had never met James Storm, who's with us right now, until about, I don't know, 2 months ago at Ric Flair's 70th birthday party. At least I think so. I don't recall us ever meeting up until then. Had we ever met?
No, that was actually the first time. And I actually don't remember too much of that night either.
It was fun, though. So you get all the brothers together, this fine collection of dudes. Everyone's having a good time. I got a great video of you doing a Angus Young duck walk in the middle of the dance floor where everybody went wild.
I actually just remember, I think it was me, you, and Jeff Hardy, the last ones to shut it down. So
as per usual. No, but it was cool to get a chance to catch up to you and kind of following what you've been doing. You are always working kind of the last of the true independent performers that you make your own schedule and do whatever you want whenever you want. It seems like every weekend you're going somewhere else, different place, different state, different country. It's kind of the way you've formed your career at this point.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of one of those things. You know, there was some stuff happening at the end of the you know, Impact TNA stuff that just kind of, I just had to take a, you know, that stuff had to take a backseat to kind of my family life. You know, I was on the road so much and, you know, I really didn't get to spend time with my family, my daughter and my sons and stuff. And I just wanted to take time and just kind of watch them grow up and just kind of be around them as, you know, as they start, you know, finding themselves as well.
Well, yeah, and that is something you realize it when you're traveling every single week, and it's the old adage that, you know, your kids grow up so fast, and when you're on the road constantly, that is totally the case, and you don't even realize it sometimes.
Yeah, the good thing about these days is, you know, you have, you know, FaceTime and all that stuff, so you can, you know, you can call home and you can kind of see your kids and stuff. You know, it wasn't that way, you know, 8-10 years ago or whatever, but, you know, it's just one of those things where, you know, at the beginning of TNA, like, I had to kind of prove myself. You know, I thought, you know, it was me and AJ and Chris Harris and Christopher Daniels and all these guys. And, you know, we were out to kind of make a name for ourselves and prove ourselves. And then, you know, 8-10 years in the TNA, I think I kind of, you know, I kind of just lost track of myself, really, and just became that guy that I didn't want to be, that I said I would never be. You know, I was just, you know, I had my certain friends and groups that I hung around with, but then everybody else, like, I really didn't care about, you know, us. You know, I can say it about myself, you know, I was kind of a dick, you know,
right.
But, you know, and I think everybody in their career kind of just goes through that point where, like, you can't really pinpoint it, but, you know, you're just a dick. Mm. And then, you know, the last little bit of TNA, like, I just kind of felt like I was just there, you know, like, not really going through the motions, but I was just there, you know, it wasn't really doing anything with me. They were paying me a lot of money, but they wouldn't really do anything with me. And it wasn't until the last contract that I had with Impact, and, you know, into the second year, I contacted their office and just sent them an email saying, look, I really don't think I want to renew my third year of my contract. I just kind of just want to go and do my own thing for a while. And it, the last night of actually up Impact, a lot of people, there's only two people in the world that knows this. Now a lot of people don't know it. Right before I went out for my match, the last Impact that I did, my little girl's mom had called me, and she said that she had found a suicide note for my daughter. Hmm. And this is literally right before my music hits. So I'm on the phone with her, and then I just hear him yelling at me, and I'm to go, go, go. And I'm sitting there talking to my daughter. I'm like, look, like, as soon as I get back from this match, I'm getting back on the phone, and we're talking and all this. And so I seen Matt Mitchell, which was Keith Mitchell's son, right before I was running out. I said, hey, whatever you do, do not shoot my face tight going down the ramp. I was bawling. Like, I was crying, you know, like, sure. Get some news like that. You know, and I got out there and I did, you know, I did my job and I came back. And as soon as I did, I, I went and got right back on the phone, and I remember Jimmy, the camera guy, he came up to me. He thought it was emotions after the match, the stuff that happened or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was on the phone with my daughter, and I said, hey, man, please just don't record this or whatever. He's like, oh, he's like, and he can tell that I was serious. He's like, oh, I'm so sorry, you know. And I just talked to my daughter, and it right then I realized, you know, I just got to get my shit together and, you know, start putting what's important to me first.
Hmm. So when you were just a couple of things, when you said that you were a dick, like, what do you mean? Just the way you treat other people or professionally, or were you kind of falling for your own bullshit?
Yeah, I think it was just really just falling for my own bullshit. You know, I really wasn't the way I treated other people. You know, like I said, everybody I worked with, like I consider a friend. I remember there'd be times at TNA where I would just do shit to try to get fired. You know, like I'd just be like a dick to the office or whatever. Like, cause I think in my mind, like, if I got fired, it'd be a whole lot easier to tell myself than me quitting, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was just one of those things where, you know, the last 4 or 5 years, like, I finally snapped out of it, you know? I met my wife, and she just finally just straightened my ass up, really.
You know, you talk about TNA because a very long run that you had there through the ups and downs. And I think sometimes people forget just how big TNA was at a certain point with the cornerstones of AJ and Crystal Daniels, like you mentioned, yourself, when you did Beer Money, when you were with Chris Harris. There was a lot of steam behind TNA at a certain point in time. How was that for you, kind of be there for the ups and downs of it all?
You know, it was fun to, you know, watch, you know, especially at the beginning when, you know, every year or every couple of months, somebody would come out saying, well, TNA is not going to last that long. You know, it's not going to last this year and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and then when we finally got the Spike deal and we started doing stuff on Spike, and that's really when stuff started, you know, booming and taking shape, because then we started traveling over to the UK where to us, like, we felt like we were actually bigger than the WWE over in the UK, because the WWE was more on a pay channel, whereas we were on a free channel. Mm-hmm. So more people were actually watching us than the WWE in the UK. And we just, you know, we'd go to these big arenas for the first time, and they'd be sold out and stuff. And we felt like rock stars, you know?
So then, was it because you feel that it always seemed like TNA had a great collection of, like, homegrown stars? Like, that was the secret to make it as the company, is to create, you know, your own attractions that weren't coming from anywhere else.
Yeah, and I think that's what it was too, is people really didn't see us as much as, you know, you say the WWE guys, just because, you know, we were on the weekly Wednesday night pay-per-views, and then, you know, we started to spin on Spike here and there. And like you said, it was really the homegrown guys. And you know, it was guys that were hungry, that kind of had a chip on their shoulder, that wanted to prove to the world, you know, when WWE didn't want us, you know, because there was a time when they could have signed AJ Styles and Daniels and all these different guys. But, you know, for some reason, Rutten, at the time, they didn't, you know, and all of us, I think, just had a chip on our shoulder and wanted to go out and show the world, like, hey, there's a reason, you know, that we're the best of the best right now.
Talk about the beginning of TNA. Like, when did you start wrestling? Was it around that time, or had you been working for a few years before that?
Actually, my first match was November 1st, 1997, against Tony Falk. Hmm. A lot of people that's been around know the name Tony Falk. You know, it's pretty crazy how many people know Tony Falk. You know, and then 2 years after I got into the business, I started working for a guy named Bert Prentice in Nashville, who actually was running kind of a developmental deal with the power plant down in Atlanta. Like, they would send guys up to Bert, and they would work their local town and stuff. And so I remember working Jen Drag and O'Hare and all these guys. And then they would actually, they started sending us to WCW as part of R&B security. And then we would have matches on, you know, Thunder and Worldwide and stuff like that. And, you know, you got to work with, you know, Chavo and all these guys, Three Count and Chronic. And, you know, it was going up there for the first time just kind of blows your mind, you know, because I was so used to really just calling stuff in the ring, you know. And then when I get up there, Chavo says all this stuff in the back, I'm like, wait a minute, I gotta remember all this shit. You know, because I was the old school Southern style where, you know, you just called it in the ring and just went with it, you know, and to remember all this stuff. And it was mind-blowing at first, but, you know, it caught on. And then, you know, 3 or 4 years later is when WCW sold out. And then, you know, it was kind of just back to the indies. And then Jeff Jarrett had called me, and he said, hey, we're starting up we're going to start up a new company, and since you're local in Tennessee, we want you to come out. You know, we need like a cowboy type character, and you know, since you have a southern accent, you know, you'd be perfect for it. I was like, all right, well, whatever you say, let's do it. Mm-hmm. And me and Chris Harris had a match. They were running, like, working on their commentary and all this stuff, and they basically, the match before the first pay-per-view, me and Chris Harris wrestled each other, and off of that match, we both got signed
to TNA, and that's when they were still doing the weekly pay-per-view type of a thing, right?
This was right before they started doing the pay-per-view. Like we had this match, and then 2 weeks later, we had the first pay-per-view in Huntsville, Alabama. And then after that pay-per-view is when we started going to the fairgrounds in Nashville.
Gotcha. Talk about your team with Chris Harris, because that was the first time you had some real steam. You guys were called the Cowboys, right? Or what were you guys called?
America's Most Wanted.
That's right.
It's one of those things where, like, we had actually been out. They were just calling us Harrison Storm or whatever. And we had went out in Nashville. And I remember we got in a little bit of trouble. And this cop actually just looked at us and said, hey, you guys keep this up. You're going to wind up on America's Most Wanted. And that's why I looked at Chris and said, hey, let's try to use that as a name. And finally, like, they didn't want us to use it, but then finally Mike Snade, like, started kind of just throwing it in there on the weekly pay-per-views, and then finally they just stuck, and they just kept calling us America's Most Wanted.
Good chemistry between you guys?
Yeah. I think it's just because we had worked with each other so long, you know, on the independence before that. You know, we had worked with each other, you know, 4 or 5 years before that, just on independence and stuff. So we kind of had each other's timing and stuff down.
When you talk about TNA, and like we were saying, when do you think it started to kind of, I mean, it was a shame when it kind of went down and went out of business. Thankfully, Impact has kind of picked up the pieces. But when you mentioned being on Spike TV, I mean, that was a huge deal to be on that channel, that big, with that much, you know, viewership. What do you think the kind of the fall of TNA was?
You know, I don't know really the whole business side. You know, I just hear stuff here and there. But it was one of those things where I heard where Spike wanted to buy into TNA at the time, and Dixie didn't really want to sell any kind of portion of it or whatever. And then not too long after that is when we were off Spike TV.
right. So you figure that's when it started kind of going downhill then?
Yeah, because, you know, you lose all those viewership on Spike at the time, and then, you know, you go to a different channel, you know, like Destination America, where not a lot of people have that channel at all, you know, and they have to get a certain package on their cable system to get it. And then, you know, that's just, to me, that was just kind of the start of the downfall. Hmm.
Were a lot of people recognizing you, like when you were on Spike? Did you have that kind of a fan following?
Yeah, it was, like I said, you know, I kind of felt like a rock star, and just, you know, going out, and, you know, it makes you feel good when you're out, you know, and people just start recognizing you, because really it only takes one person to kind of recognize you to come get a picture with you, and then people who don't even freaking know you, like, come up and get pictures with you just because this person was like, hey, I think he's famous, let's get a picture with him.
When you guys, when, because the America's Most Wanted, and then we'll talk about Beer Money as well, was quite popular. What was, when you were a heel, did you have a lot of heat with all the different things that you were doing?
Yeah, I thought it was real good, you know, especially when we turned heel, and then, you know, we got Gail on our team and all this stuff. And, you know, we had lined with Jarrett for a little bit, but, you know, the America's Most Wanted team, I thought, fit it more as a heel group. And it was just one of those things where we were having fun as heels. You know, I had been babyface really like my entire career. And so for that change to be heels as America's Most Wanted was really refreshing.
Talk about Beer Money, because with Bobby Roode being in the WWE now, obviously, and you're working around the world, but that was a really popular, you know, successful act for you two guys.
Yeah, and it was another one of those things where we really wasn't meant to be a tag team. We were just meant to be put together for a couple shows, and that was it. Because Judge came up to us, and he's like, look, we don't have nothing. He goes, I'm going to be honest. We don't have nothing for you, and we don't have nothing for you. So we're just going to put you together for a couple weeks so we can figure something out. And they basically was just calling us Rude and Storm as well. And then this time it just caught on. And I remember me and Bobby talking, and Bobby was like, we got to come up with something so stupid that the fans will fool us. Like, and that's how we came up with, like, just a double suplex, and we did Beer Money after it. And then after, you know, after a couple months, then we noticed that the people started doing it with us. I was like, uh-oh, we're about to turn baby. And it wasn't too long after that when the office was like, look, okay, we're going to keep you guys together, and now we're about to turn into a baby face thing.
How'd you come up with the name Beer Money?
Me and Bobby was sitting at a bar, the L House down in Orlando, and I was sitting there with him. It was me, him, EY, and a couple other guys, and Eric Young. And I just remember saying, man, I need some damn beer money or whatever. And Bobby just kind of looked at me. He was like, huh. And then we got to thinking, you know, since he was supposed to be Billy from Wall Street and then me, like, the beer drink or whatever, was like, perfect. Let's see if we can use it. And they, and TNA, once again, didn't want to use that name because they were going to start coming out with toys and stuff for Walmart and all this stuff. So on our action figures, it doesn't say beer money. It says Rude and Storm on them.
What, beer money's too controversial?
I know, right? I'm just like, what? Are you kidding me? It's Walmart. All the people that shop at Walmart are people who drink beer.
When you have an act like that, and once again, you know, Bobby was in NXT for a while and all that sort of thing. Did you ever think about trying to get that rolling again and take it to WWE when you guys were in Impact or even now?
You know, we had talked about it, but like I think so many people had just put it in our heads that WWE would never use the name Beer Money just because, you know, I don't know why, but and I was always one. There's a lot of other guys were saying, you know, that, you know, if WWE did it right, like Beer Money could make, you know, WWE a lot of money just from merchandise sales. Like we made TNA so much money just off our T-shirts and stuff. It was ridiculous.
Well, because it's a cool name, right? I guess maybe with WWE and beer is always synonymous with Stone Cold Steve Austin, but that was 10 years ago now. You could do, like you said, more with the Beer Money name now for sure.
Yeah, and actually, it wasn't too long I was talking to Steve, and he was telling me, he goes, I'm so pissed at you guys. Like, I wish I would have came up with the name Beer Money.
So let's talk more about what you've kind of been doing now with all the independent shows and all that sort of thing. Where are you right now?
I am in Halifax, Nova Scotia right now.
Right.
So I'm doing a three-show tour right now, and then I leave Sunday and fly to Chicago and do the Ring of Honor pay-per-view. So I'm staying busy. And so I didn't really know how big Nova Scotia was until we started driving all over it.
You said you had a long travel day to get there?
Yeah, like so Wednesday I leave. I'm supposed to be leaving Nashville, and I get there within the 30-minute window when you're supposed to check in. I get there with 34 minutes left. So the lady, she's like, oh, you just barely made it. So I'm like, yeah, sweet, cool. So she checks my bags in, and then when she goes to check me in, it's under the 30-minute window. And so the gate agent has shut it off and gave my seat to someone else. So I was like, well, what's that mean? She goes, well, we have to reschedule you to fly out tomorrow. And I was like, wait, no, like I have a show. Like I can't, you know, and I've never missed a show. And I was like, I'm not missing the show. And she goes, well, your bags are on its way. And I was just like, so I looked on my app and I seen a flight on Southwest. And I was like, look, I'm just going to go buy this Southwest flight that goes to LaGuardia where my connection is supposed to be. I just get on the connection and then everything will be good. So I get on the Southwest and I have an hour with Southwest to get to my connection. So I fly out, get to LaGuardia, and my gate is in a completely different terminal. And I think LaGuardia is the only airport in the world where you have to go outside the terminal to get to another terminal. Like, you have to go outside the airport, get on a shuttle. And, of course, I get on this stupid shuttle, and it gets stuck in the traffic at LaGuardia. So then I get to the gate, and I miss my connection by 5 minutes. I'm like, are you kidding me? So now I have to stay in LaGuardia. I had to stay in New York overnight, and then I buy me a flight on Air Canada because they wouldn't get me to, you know, my show till like 8:30 at night, and it was a 3-hour drive to the show. So I buy a flight on Air Canada that gets me to Toronto, and it flies me to Halifax. And then just today I just received my bags, because when I looked on the app flying out of LaGuardia, they said my bags are still there and they didn't go through to Halifax because of customs or something. Shit. And so when I go to get on my Air Canada flight, I'm like, oh, I have enough time to go over to Delta to get my bags. So I go over to Delta and to get my bags to start checking in on Air Canada. And they don't open up till 7 a.m. The baggage service does. And my flight is at 6:30. I was like, So lucky I did the old, you know, I never pack my gear when I'm going to shows or whatever. So I mean, check my gear. So I had my gear with me. At least I was able to work in my gear.
Yeah, you never check your bags. Never check your gear, kid. That's always the rule, right?
That's what I learned, you know, because if I did, it would have been the old, oh, we're having a street fight tonight.
but see, people don't understand all the stuff that we go through sometimes to get to these shows and get to these towns. And like you said, something like LaGuardia, we actually have to go outside to make a connection. People don't think of that sort of thing.
No, and it was one of those things, like when me and my wife got together, she just thought I wrestled on TV and that was it. I'm like, no, I'm doing all these other shows, you know, because we was running house shows and all that at the time. You know, we was running 3 or 4 house shows a week. And now, you know, it's funny because now doing independence, I'm actually wrestling more than I did the last 2 years of my TNA contract.
Well, yeah, because TNA was running a few shows a month, but you were going out basically every weekend, right?
Yeah, and it's good too because I don't want to sound corny or whatever, but I kind of just found myself again and just my love for pro wrestling. You know, just going out and traveling with the guys and you know, putting on a great show and heading to the next town the next day.
Who organizes all your bookings? Do you do it all yourself, or do you have like a manager that helps you, or an agent, or anything like that?
No, I actually do it all myself because you know. That way, nothing gets confused. Nothing. It's not that he says, she says stuff. It's like, look, this is what we agreed upon, and let's do it.
You use social media quite a lot to your advantage, which is smart because I think that's the best way to kind of promote yourself in this day and age and let people know what's going on and what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, and case in point, you know, with, you know, Cody and the Bucks and all that, like, if people want to see how I use social media, just look at those guys. You know, they got it down to a pinpoint, you know. Mm-hmm. And like you said, nowadays, it's like if we don't have TV exposure, really, that's the only kind of exposure that you can get yourself out with, you know, with the Instagram stories or Instagram or Twitter and all this stuff. And so, like you said, I try to take advantage of that as much as I can.
And one of your big catchphrases is shit it and get it.
that's what my grandpa always tells me. He goes, boy, don't just sit there. He goes, you got shit and get it. So
you got to put that on a t-shirt, man.
Yeah, no, I got to hurry and put it on a t-shirt for somebody else, though. That's for sure.
So when you go travel, like, do you have to carry all your merch with you, sort of thing, or do you mail it out, or how does that part of it work?
No, like Billy Gunn always makes fun of me because like at shows, like I basically get like a flea market set up. Like, I got pictures and hats and, you know, basically like every kind of merchandise I can come up with, you know, shot glasses and regular glasses, hats and blah, blah, blah. And so like usually like, on my Insta stories, I always tag Billy in them and just say, you know, setting up my flea market, you know, just for you, Billy. So,
you know, I used to work at Smoky Mountain Wrestling with the Rock and Roll Express, like in the Knoxville area. And those guys were the kings of that. They would have, like you said, all the shirts and all the pictures, but then they would go to a store, like a Walmart. They'd buy a sheet. They'd cut the sheet into 20 strips. They'd write R&R on it, and they'd be official Rock and Roll Express headbands.
I still see so many guys who go to like the dollar stores and buy like the little keychains that you can put the pictures in and stuff, mm-hmm. You know, sell those and stuff. So they still have the little 4x6 pictures and stuff. So,
but see, that's the thing. Like when you work, let's say you work in WWE or, you know, TNA at the time or whatever it may be, the merchandise is kind of all inclusive in your deal. When you're doing the independent scene, you're making, you know, 100% of that merch, whatever you sell that night. So you could be making even more money in gimmicks than you could from your actual wrestling match.
Yeah, there's been a lot of nights where I've made, you know, and you get those crowds. You just love those crowds because sometimes you can get big crowds that don't buy anything. But then you get these smaller crowds that you're making, you know, $10 a head off of. That's just buy everything that you got, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it just teaches you like how to hustle, really, you know, how to hustle people out of their money.
Have you thought, actually, I was going to ask you one more thing about your social media. You have a character that's on there quite a bit, Django. How did that all come about?
It's really like a Southern wrestling fan. I don't want to stereotype, but you know how it is. But it's one of those things where me and one of my buddies, Chase Stevens, was going to a show, And I win so many bets by going down the highway with guys, and I ask them how long do they think the white lines in the middle of the road is on the highway, and every one of them say 3 or 4 feet. Mm-hmm. And I say, no, it's not. They're 10 feet long. Mm-hmm. And they're like, what? No way. And I'm like, okay, well, let's stop the car and lay down in the middle of the highway, and we're going to find out. And so me and Chase was traveling to Kentucky, and it was late at night. And so as he starts slowing down, you know, the lines are getting bigger and bigger, you know, because we're running 70, 80, so they look 3 or 4 feet, you know. And he's like, oh, God. So he has to get out and lay in the middle of the road. Well, while he's laying there, this car comes by and almost hits him. Like, why he's laying in the road? So I'm like recording this, and then we get to the hotel, and I'm usually one of those guys hate rooming with, because I wake up in the morning and I got the music blaring and I'm singing way off key, and they're just like, shut up, like, go the freak to bed. And so I was like, I got up and I was sitting outside, and I saw this fishing boat with like this guy in it, like, from, you know, he was way deep south. And I was just like, man, I'm about to do a video and just act like that guy right there, like what I would think he would act like. Mm-hmm. And that's how it really all came about. Like, I shot this one video like 10 times, just try to get the accent down right, and, you know, turn my hat sideways like he had it and all this stuff. And ever since then, I've been doing it. And so many people have hit me up, you know, Carl Anderson and Ken Anderson, and like all these guys are like, dude, like, you have to do more videos of the Django to Django.
It's almost, you can make it your alter ego, like Mick Foley and Dude Love.
Yeah. It's just fun doing it. And I did one in the Delta Skyroom, and when I was coming back from Scotland, and people are looking at me in the Skyroom like, what the is wrong with this guy here? Because I was like, man, that darn old dang came out there and didn't see him. I'm fishing all the time. It's a good time. I tell you what, man.
What was it? Give me another example. That's great.
I was like, the Django to Django is like James Storm's biggest number one fan or whatever.
Right.
So it was like the Django to Django went to Scotland to watch James Storm wrestle, and like he went fishing when I was there, and he talked a lot in his monster. Uh-huh. And he was like, I'll try to redo it real quick. He's like, man, I was out there fishing, man, and I snagged this monster, man. He came up railing up, and this damn game warden came over, and he said, James Storm, you can't be catching that monster. I said, why not? He said, that thing's a national treasure. I said, national treasure? Shit, I'm gonna be rich. And he said, no, you got to let that thing go. And all of a sudden I looked down, and that damn monster had done gotten off my fishing rod. And I looked at that game warden. I said, game warden, be gone.
So you said that Carl Anderson and Ken Anderson liked that one?
Yeah. Oh, they freaking loved it. So now, like, seriously, like, I'm going to start selling this damn, it's just baby powder, but it's like, I call it Be Gone Dust, where I hit somebody with it and they disappear. So I shot a video with one of my sons, and my wife got so mad because it was my son. So I grabbed like a handful, like a shit ton of like baby powder in my hand. And he was like, daddy, 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 daddy. And I just threw it, hit him right in the face. And it just like, he had just gotten out of the bathtub, so it like stuck right to his face. And he's like trying to spit it out.
Be gone.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Well, I mean, that's the thing, like you said, like, when you're on the road, you have to do stuff to have a good time and keep your mind clean, right?
Yeah. I mean, we like, you know, we entertain ourselves, you know. If we don't start entertaining ourselves, that's when we start getting in trouble.
When you go to these independent shows, do you kind of like just trust whoever it is the promoter wants you to wrestle, or do you kind of scout them out a bit, or how do you decide?
I go and I'll see if I can find any kind of like YouTube video on them or something like that, because, you know, you never know what you're getting into when you do these independent shows, you know, the skill level. And I've learned that I've had to kind of, you know, as I say, dummy it down a little bit, because I realized with like my timing is so used to being on, you know, a higher scale with guys who can go and stuff. And then when you come to independent shows, you know, their timing might not be as good. So, you know, you have to kind of slow it down just a little bit.
Yeah, because you'll be able to figure that right away. Because the last thing you want to do is, because I'm assuming when a guy with your name value goes to a show, they're going to put you with kind of the best guy in the company, right?
Well, you would think that. Sometimes you wonder, like, wait, is this the best guy you have to offer? But yeah, a lot of times, yeah, you know, they try to put me with the best guy that they have.
Because, like I said, when you're going to like Halifax, Canada, it would seem, you know, I don't even really know anybody that's from Halifax as far as enough to be a wrestling territory there.
Yeah, on this tour, I'm working a guy named Marcus Burt, who's really good. He actually looks like a smaller version of Triple H.
Okay.
I mean, he's really good. He's one of the top guys. And I think, you know, sooner or later, you'll start hearing more of the Marcus Burt name.
Right on, man. When you were talking about being a heel, do you enjoy being a heel and getting that type of heat where people are attacking you or you have to fight people off, that sort of a thing?
Yeah, you know, it's easy for me to be babyface just because I have so much charisma. Like, I just, you know, I kind of know how to interact with people really good, you know, with crowds and stuff. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, there's nothing, like, better than being a heel and just having people, you know, spit at you or throw stuff at you who, like, legit get pissed off at you. You know, it wasn't too long ago I was at a show in deep South Alabama, and this lady tried to hit me with a sock full of nickels. So it was just one of those things where, you know, I was sitting there making fun of her because she didn't have any teeth. So I'm sitting there going, come on, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then, like, had this bag of nickels in her purse and tried to hit me with it.
So it's always the old lady. It's like the old lady in the front row with the hat pin that tries to stab you with it.
Right. And it's just, like I said, you know, it's, I don't know. And it's just so funny just watching, you know, some of these other guys who get so pissed off at you as well. You know, these, you know, 20, 21 year olds, you know, they like, it's easy to piss them off.
Have you ever been in a fight with a fan?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I've beat the shit out of them. Like, there was one time but it was basically where they jumped in the ring. You know, we were down in this place called Dixon, Tennessee. And I remember this guy tries to get in the ring with this pool stick. And it was me and this guy named Ashley Hudson and this other guy named Corey Williams. And he tries to get in. And, of course, fans really don't know how to get into a wrestling ring.
Right.
So you know, they're coming in trying to stumble. And the guy just, like, as soon as he, like, goes down, he just drops his stick or whatever. As soon as he comes up, I just catch him with the right. He just goes right out. So, and there, it's funny because there was one incident on Impact where Jeff is in the ring and this fan is yelling at him. And me and Chris Harris are watching from, like, this little cat tower that was at the arena. And so Jeff's, like, arguing with this fan that has a mask on. And it's on YouTube somewhere. And all of a sudden, you see Jeff's like, come on. And Samoa Joe's in the ring with him. And I was like, okay, I don't know if I was a fan if I would want to jump in the ring with those guys. Like, you know, like,
yeah,
Joe's just going to eat your lunch. You <know? laughs> And so Joe just kind of sits back in the corner, just watches the whole thing. And security let this guy through because he has a wrestling mask on, so they think he's part of the show. Well, he jumps up on the ring apron to get in, and Jeff's like trying to block him. And I was like, wait a minute, this is a shoot. And you just see me come out of nowhere and just grab this guy from the back, and I just start waylaying him. And you see, like, his white mask just turns red, like, and he just goes down.
no legal ramifications from that.
No, thank God. And then me and Chris, we just went back to the catwalk and started drinking beer and watching the show.
End of story, right?
Yeah, end of story.
So, well, let me ask you a question about NXT, because I heard that you had worked there for a bit and it seemed, yeah, like you might have been going there, and then obviously you didn't go there. So I was wondering, what was the story with that?
You know, it was one of those things with the family deal as well. Like, I went down and had the match and talked to Hunter and everything. And then they wanted me to come back for the second match. And I went back and I was talking to him, and I actually showed him, like, the contract that TNA offered me. Like, I had it. I was like, look, this is, you know, that's like, and he was talking about how they're going to be running between, you know, 125, 130 shows and all this. And I said, right now, I said, my wife was wanting to have another kid, but she had to do the shots and stuff in order for us to have the kid. And so basically where I had to be home, you know, and have sex when the moon touches the sand and the fish, you know, whatever. So me and him, and he's really cool. He sat there and talked to me about it and stuff. And he actually told me, he said, look, he goes, I can't tell someone to pass up guaranteed money, especially when it's that amount. especially being in a business like this. He goes, but to me, he goes, I don't think you'll be here down in NXT that long. He goes, but, you know, I'm not the one that makes that call. He goes, but I will tell you this. He goes, take the TNA deal, get your life straight, and then get yourself in the best shape you can. In 2 years, call me back.
Hmm. So how long ago was that?
That was 2.5 years ago.
sounds like you owe him a call.
Well, I've tried. Yeah. I think you changed his number.
But in the meantime, like you said, I mean, you're keeping very busy doing all these things that you're doing. So what is your overall mindset and plan? Do you want to continue just making your own schedule and having that freedom? Or do you want to try and go work for a national company again?
Yeah, no, I definitely, you know, to me, I think I've been doing the independence long enough, and just kind of like fell back in love with wrestling. And now, you know, like I want to start working towards, you know, being back with a national promotion, you know, because I think I still have a lot to offer. And, you know, I'm in the best shape that I've ever been in my career. So I'm smarter too. So that kind of helps out. You know,
well, it makes it big.
Go ahead. Not as dumb and wild as I was.
Well, that makes a big difference too, because wrestling is about being smart, not just in the ring, but out of it as well.
Yeah, and so many people don't understand that, and it just took me so long to kind of, you know, realize that, you know, because I was one of the guys that, you know, Mr. Perfect had a lot to, he helped me out a lot when I was, you know, when he was in TNA, and he would always tell me, he goes, one day it's going to click for you, and you're going to realize that the most important move is the move between moves. And for so long, I was like, what the hell is this old man talking about? Like, you know, but I am not going to say that to Mr. Perfect because he's going to put me in a pretzel, you know. But
right.
But it was just one of those things where it just finally clicked. I was just like, man, like I can just put this guy down with a punch. And if I do it correctly, all I got to do is just turn and look at the crowd and they'll pop or boo. You know, like I don't have to hit this guy with another big move. Like just me just reacting kind of to the crowd without going, oh, you suck or whatever. You know, there's a way to do it, you know, properly. And it just finally just clicked where, you know, like it's just working smarter and saving your body, really.
Well, and that's the secret too. I mean, you're talking about a guy like Perfect. He taught me there's no such thing as rest holds. They're wear down holds. Never treat it as a rest. Always treat it. And even if you're in one, you should always be trying to fight and get out of it, move around. Because the rest hold is just that. It slows everything right down, and it's just kind of a break in the middle where you shouldn't have one.
Right, exactly. And I remember coming back from a match, you know, and like there's nothing like when you're feeling good after a match because you think everything went great. You know, we're walking back. It was Triple X and America's Most Wanted. I'm coming back. I'm like, yeah, man, it's a great match. All of a sudden, I hear Storm, come the fuck here. I'm like, oh god. I did not like the tone of that voice. So I walk over to him and he says, what'd you do that for? And I was trying to explain to him. And I was like, you talking about like do that spot? He goes, no, I'm talking about why did you pick that guy up off the ground to go do the spot?
Right.
And, you know, and for a while I was like, wait, no, cause we're going to do the spot. He goes, never pick a guy up off the ground when his shoulders are down. He goes, you're trying to tell everybody that, you know, that you don't want to win now. He goes, it's that guy's job to get his shoulders up off the ground and feet somewhere, and then you can do the spot. Hmm. You know, and I was just like, huh. I'm like, okay. So now I try to tell that to everybody. I'm like, if a guy's shoulders on the ground, keep pinning him until he feeds somewhere else. And I tell everybody, I'm like, you watch Jeff Hardy. It takes like a semi-truck to keep Jeff Hardy down. Mm-hmm. Like, you hit him, he's back up, you know, in a different corner somewhere. So.
Yeah, but that's the thing. It was cool for TNA. At the time, you mentioned Perfect, Kurt Hennig. There was a lot of those type of guys. Did you learn a lot from all those cavalcade of legends that worked there?
Yeah, like, you know, and Dusty, like I got pretty tight with Dusty when he was there. We teamed up for, you know, a good 6-8 months there. And
oh, wow.
just watching him in the ring and just how he controlled a crowd just with his body movement, you know. And I remember there was a spot in the match where he was going to take his boot off and throw it to me. And I was going to hit Lance Hoyt with it and then cover him. And he told me, he goes, cowboy, he goes, if I fall down, taking my boot off, make sure everybody else falls down too. So it doesn't look like a blown spot. I was like, all right, Dusty. Sounds good.
I mean, that's pretty cool right there to see you team with Dusty Rhodes for 8 months. Tell us some Dusty stories.
Yeah, I mean, it was just one of the things where he told me, he's like, cowboy, if you're going to play a cowboy, you need to get you a cowboy hat. Because I wasn't coming out with a cowboy hat at first. You know, they just had me playing a cowboy character. I didn't really know, you know.
Right.
And it wasn't long when Savage came in, and Savage came up to me. He goes, that's a nice cowboy hat you got there. Because, you know, he was wearing the cowboy hats too. He goes, if you want to stand out in this business, you got to put some color on it. And I was like, huh. And so then after, you know, a couple weeks after that is when I started getting this guy in L.A. to start painting stuff on my hats and stuff. And I came back and he gave me his approval. He was like, all right, that looks good. I was like, sweet.
Well, and then that's one thing Jimmy Hart always told me. It's like, you got to have color. Everybody has black. You know, you have to have color. Right.
You watch TV now, it seems like everybody is wearing black. And I told Steve Austin, I said, I blame you. I blame you for people cheering the heels. I blame you for everybody wearing black.
That is the truth, though, right? I forgot that Savage was there in TNA. Hogan and Bischoff. And did you work with any of those guys?
Yeah, you know, I remember me and Hogan did a deal in London. It was me, him, and Bully on the same team. And I remember Hogan saying that he was going to do the big boot, but he wanted me to do the leg drop. And I looked at him. I said, with all due respect, I'll do it in a heartbeat because you want me to. I said, but I don't think it's going to get the same effect. But I did it. I did it.
Yeah. Not exactly the same career highlight as it would be. But you mentioned, too, hanging out afterwards. I know the Ale House in Orlando is always the place. Did those guys go out and have some drinks with you guys, too?
They mostly stayed at the hotel bar and stuff like that, because the hotel bar was good at kind of keeping fans out, you know, letting the guys have their time. You know, it would be Hogan and Flair and stuff in there. And, you know, after the house, we all go back to the hotel and sit out there and just kind of drink with them. And I remember Keith Mitchell, he'd always have a place called the Red River Saloon, and it'd just be out back, and it'd just be all the guys, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, just sitting out there telling war stories about how cool we used to be and stuff.
Did you, is that how you became friends with Flair to end up at his birthday party?
No, I think, when he came into TNA, you know, I was one of the first guys to kind of greet him and stuff. And I actually knew Reed. And that's how I kind of knew Flair when he came in. Like, I just talked to him again. He's like, oh yeah, cowboy, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's just one of those things where, you know, and it's cool because I text him or call him up and he'll answer. And you know, I went down when he was in the hospital, you know, about this last time, and drove down to Atlanta and stayed there with him overnight and helped him get up and start walking again and stuff. And it was just funny because he just had that robe on, you know, and like, I'm trying to help him out of bed and like his junk just falls out. And I said, Rick, come on, man. He goes, it's okay, it's Space Mountain. I said, that something is out of control right now. Like, it's not working. And so, like, I had to walk him around the hospital, like, his butt hanging out. So, I mean, it was me, him, and Wendy was just walking around. So, like, that's just one of the good Flair stories I got. The rest of them, you know, they're a little full.
The rest of you can't really tell on air, right?
Rest of them, I get a lot of heat from them if I tell those.
As we start to wind down here, I want to talk about some of your matches that you had in TNA, because there were so many, you know, becoming the champion and that sort of thing. Who were some of your favorite opponents to work when you were there?
You know, it was funny because definitely Chris Harris, when we had a Texas Death match, and I think one of my favorite opponents was Kurt and also Bobby, you know, when me and Bobby started having our feud against each other, just because, like, we just kind of had the same mindset. And I think Bobby just kind of made the perfect heel at the time against me as well. And it was just one of those things, like I said, we just had chemistry. And we really didn't even have to really call stuff. We just act and react off each other's body movements.
Mm-hmm. And who did you win the world title from?
Kurt. So oh, wow. it was just one of those things where, you know, the night before, Kurt told me, he goes, I want you to put this match together, blah, blah, blah. So it made me feel good that he just believed in me enough to put the whole match together. And so when I get there, I tell him this whole thing, and then come to find out, he had a torn hamstring. And I was like, oh my God. He's like, yeah, I can't. And if you watch the match, like, he has it wrapped up and stuff, and he can't really go. He's like, look, he goes, I know that, you know, we were supposed to do 15 minutes. He goes, it's going to mean more if you go out there and you beat me in 30 seconds. And it did. And it always makes me feel good, because that was actually the highest rated show in Impact history. It was the night that I won the world title.
Really?
So, yeah. So that's when we went over the million viewer mark and everything. And like, if you go back and you watch that, like, that place just went absolutely ape shit. Like, and it was just good. And it was just that moment where, you know, people say, oh, it's a world title, blah, 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 wrestling title, whatever. But, you know, for a lot of the workers, like, it kind of means something. It's like the company is kind of like, here, you know, you deserve this, you earn this, you know, master time and whatever. And it was just one of those things where, you know, as soon as it would just had Kurt just beat me down in the corner, as soon as it turned around, I just super kicked and pinned him 1, 2, 3. And while I was pinning him, he just looks at me, he goes, thanks, buddy. I said, no, thank you, man.
Well, it's kind of the equivalent of like winning an Oscar, because it shows that you are, you know, you're worth it to the company to be the face of the company, which you were the face of the company.
Yeah. And people were like, oh, well, your title reign was short, blah, blah. Like, to me, like, baby faces shouldn't be holding on to a belt that long anyways. Like, it's always good to watch the chase than it is to see the baby face running around with the belt.
Mm-hmm. So you only had it for a short time?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
A couple hours?
a couple blinks and that was it.
I had the world title for a commercial break once. It's not shorter than that. Hey,
you beat me then.
what do you think happened with Chris Harris in WWE? Because he came and went so fast.
Well, like I said, you know, I'm not 100%, but I just heard that he just kind of just came there with an attitude, you know. Mm. And I heard that one time, I guess they asked him to get in the ring with Fit and kind of just roll around and do stuff, whatever, and he refused to. And I heard it was from there, it was just downhill. But it was one of those things where right before he went, like, we got word that WWE was interested in both of us as a tag team. Mm-hmm. But I had another year left on my contract. And I told Chris, I said, hey, I said, re-sign with TNA for another year. I said, then after that, we can go together. And it was just one of those things, I think, where he thought that he had to go then. And so, you know, he went by himself and, you know, the rest is history.
Hmm. How about the beer drinking championship? The TNA World Beer Drinking Championship.
That was like one of those things where, you know, you're backstage and you say something and then one of the writers or something hears it and they're like, oh, well, let's just try this. Sounds so stupid that it might work or whatever. And it was something where a fan had given me a John Cena spinner belt. And so, like, it was like, you know, the foam belt and had the spinner. So I had props like drill a beer bottle on the front of it or whatever. And so we're just walking around backstage, me and Eric Young and stuff, like, oh, we're going to wrestle for the beer drinking championship. And then I think it was Dutch that heard it. He was like, oh, we're going to put that in the show or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so we would actually get paid just to show up and drink beer. Like, there was one time we had a breathalyzer and I had like a 1.2 like BCA, like it was unreal. So I was like, okay, well, this is fun. Then there was one time when it was me and Bobby Roode against Eric Young and Orlando Jordan, and me and EY would always do a spot where he would slide out of the ring and run around and grab my beer and then chuck it down or whatever. I'd be like, don't you drink my beer, don't you drink. Mm-hmm. And then he'd drink it or whatever. And we did that on TV and house shows and all this. And then there was one match right toward the end where me and Bobby are backstage and I poured the beer out. And he goes, what are you doing? And I filled the bottle up with Jaeger. and so we're out there and here we go. We're running that spot. He gets out, runs around, grabs the beer. And I'm like, don't you drink my beer. He just grabs it. He starts chugging it. And you just see his eyes just like, what the hell? And then you see Jaeger going through his beer. He's like, oh, he's about to throw up.
Oh, well, beer drinking, man. That's like you said, that you are the champion of it. And you also mentioned, too, singing in your car. What kind of tunes do you like?
I'm more of a, you know, people always think that I'm a country guy, but I'm not. I'm more of like a Warrant, White Snake kind of like 80s rock guy, you know, White Line and all that stuff. Like, I just, you know, stuff like that. Like, you know, I like 80s rap and stuff. You know, I don't really like too much of the new stuff. You know, I like, you know, with country, it's Johnny Cash and Kris Kristofferson, you know, guys like that.
Mm, gotcha. Are you a Tim McGraw guy?
Yeah, I guess I have to be because I'm friends with him.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, my mom, she works for him. Like, she's worked for him for, like, the last, you know, 15 years or so. So.
Oh, so you guys are buds?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Do you hang out at his place or anything like that?
Well, they moved now, I guess, because I was coming over so much. But like their farm used to be about, you know, about 5 or 10 miles down the road from my house.
Oh, wow. I'm sure it was a big place, right?
Oh, yeah. It was actually a historic place. Like Hank Williams used to live there in the house, and like all these other like famous country stars used to live in his house. And then they moved in, you know, remodeled it and all that, and built a studio.
Man. So last couple of things. So just tell me just what's your schedule for the next month? Like you said, you're in Halifax now. Just trying to get a sense of where you go to. Is it across the entire country?
Yeah, basically. So this month, like I said, I'm in Nova Scotia doing a 3-day tour. Then I fly to Chicago, do the pay-per-view. Then I'm home for 3 days. And then I drive down to Montgomery, Alabama for a show. And then I fly to New York that Saturday for a show. And then I fly back home Sunday to go to church. And then basically kind of start my week over, you know, waking my kids up and send them to school. And then head back out the next weekend after that. And then the weekend after that, I'm in Vegas.
Well, so you said you're doing the Ring of Honor pay-per-view. Are you working with them now as well?
Yeah, it's just one of those things where, you know, they call me up and, you know, want to bring me in. And I kind of think I would fit in good there as a heel because to me, like, especially at this point in my career, I'm one of those guys who would like to work with the younger guys because I can take and feed and, you know, catch all these guys doing these moves. But, you know, like, I can't do all these flips anymore. So, But it's just one of those things where I can kind of teach these guys, you know, maybe you don't put the flip here. Maybe you put it here at the end or something, you know.
Did you used to do flips? You said you didn't do them anymore.
Yeah, it's actually funny because the early part in TNA, like I was doing moonsaults and, you know, tilt the world head scissors and all this. and it was actually Dusty who said, you tell me when the last time you saw a cowboy do a backflip. And he goes, you got to stay true to your character. I was like, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I think a guy like you in Ring of Honor would be good because it's almost like having Bully Ray there, and you've got so many guys, and it's not all about flips, but there's guys that are much more aerial, you know, based and that sort of thing. But to have a guy like you that's more of a character performer might be something good for them at this point.
Yeah, because, you know, I always say, like, if you have too much of the same stuff on a show, then, you know, there's only so much of that you can watch. You know, you gotta kind of split it up. You know, like I said, you know, you want your high impact aerial maneuver guys on the show, but you also got to have the guys who are there with character and story driven, you know.
Last few things, what are your favorite matches you ever had or a couple favorite matches?
I would definitely say my favorite match that I've had would probably be the me and Bobby Roode match from Bound for Glory, like 2012 down in Phoenix. That was one of the matches where the office just said, hey, you guys just go out and do whatever you want. And so, you know, we just kind of went out there and we basically beat the hell out of each other. Because I always tell people, the closer friends you are with the guys, the more you beat each other up, which is right. Weird.
and you and Bobby.
Why are you hitting me so hard? We're friends.
And you and Bobby are still close friends to this day?
You know, I don't say we were like super close anyways, but I mean, it's still one of those things where I'm you know, we keep in touch and stuff. So, and it's one of those things like people are like, oh, you have to be mad that he's doing this. No, like he's one of my friends. Like I'm happy for him. You know, that's what he wanted to do. This is what I wanted to do. So,
do you think there'd ever be a Beer Money reunion?
You know, it's one of those things in wrestling, never say never. I think if it's the right place and the right time, it'll definitely happen. You know, but like I said, you know, so many people said, like, especially with what he's doing now, like, you know, when they did stuff with Chad Gable and stuff, if they would have brought me in, like, that would have been the perfect time to put us back together, you know?
Oh, I see, to kind of have break up with him and because of you and you do the reunion there or something like that.
Yeah, and Bobby would be like, look, you're not the partner that I wanted, you know? Mm-hmm. And I actually remember Flair just saying not too long ago, like, he wanted to try to pitch an idea to Vince where he was actually me and Bobby's manager and then somehow get Charlotte involved in the storyline and kind of be like a new Fortune kind of deal.
And Fortune was the group that you had in TNA.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Well, it's very cool, man. It's cool to get a chance to talk to you. And like you said, man, you've been doing the independent thing. It's time for you to get back on a national scale very soon. So I'm sure it's going to happen, whether it's WWE or NXT or AEW or even Impact. I guess just a matter of getting in their faces again.
Yeah, that's what it is. Just, you know, I can't control what I can't control. You know, I can only do what I'm able to do. And that's, you know, staying in the gym and staying ready. And that way, when the opportunity comes, that, you know, I'm, you know, as Jim Ross said, you know, companies don't want to wait on you to get in shape. They want you to be in ready mode when they call you.
Oh, absolutely. Is there any guys on the independent scene that stand out to you that you think are going to be future stars?
You know, there's definitely a lot of guys. There's a lot of guys that I work with over in at ICW over in Scotland. Mm. And like their talent roster is just insane. Some of the guys that they have over there, you know, and I know a lot of the guys AEW has, you know, started picking up and stuff. So, and I think especially with the UK, like it's starting to, I think people are really starting to take notice of the talent that's over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they draw a lot of people over there too for those shows.
And it's good because like they're kind of an old school crowd too. Like, you know, they still cheer the baby faces and boo the heels, and they're drunk as hell while they're doing it. So,
hey man, the drunker they get, the better you are.
Exactly. The more merch I can sell, hopefully.
All right, let's get one last message from Django before we split.
Hey, man, I tell you what, man, next time you do it, you got to have me on that show. I come out here all the time, and I kick somebody's ass. Oh, James Storm, he's a pretty good boy, but I tell you what, you ain't seen no muscles like this. I look at him and say, hey, you want shit and get it? Won't you come get it? Does this look like a weakling to you? I don't think so. I'll whoop your ass, boy. How big a boy are you? You better pack a lunch.
You sound like half the people in Halifax, the Newfoundlanders. All right, brother. Good talking to you, man. Have a great show tonight, and be safe. We'll see you around on the road.
Yeah, thank you so much, brother.
All right, cheers, man. Bye. All right, the Highwayman, Cowboy James Storm, is taking on Nick Aldis for the NWA World Heavyweight Championship in a best 2 out of 3 falls this Saturday, December 14th, at the NWA Into the Fire pay-per-view event in Atlanta, Georgia. The NWA National Championship will also be decided in a triple threat match featuring Colt Cabana, Aaron Stevens, and Ricky Starks, and it's the Rock and Roll Express versus the Wild Cards, Thomas Latimer and Royce Isaacs, for the NWA Tag Team Championships. The NWA Into the Fire pay-per-view event is sold out live, but you can watch it live on the Fight TV app. Go check that out, and maybe James Storm will become Le Champion of NWA. All right, coming up Friday, Michael Sweet returns to Talk Is Jericho. The singer of one of my favorite bands, Striper, has a new solo album out called 10, because it's his 10th solo record. He's got a guest guitarist and vocalist on every song, including Rich Ward. And we're also going to talk about the 33rd anniversary of one of the greatest rock and roll albums of all time, To Hell with the Devil. Michael's going to tell us the whole story behind it, where Striper was at the time, and how that album shot them to the stratosphere and made them rock and roll superstars. Michael Sweet returns on Friday. Until then, we'll see ya. Stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy. Shit and get it. Yeah.